Good evening. This is John McCune's music. Wow. She's not with us. I'm sorry for that, but you and I think we're going to have a terrific show. So we heard a little bit of John McCune's music, and if you, Brian, probably remember John McCune, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, he owns part of our station with Ruthie DiTucci, and so his music is just prolific, you know, on all these shows.
Right.
And so that, I don't know what on earth happened, but something. Anyway, technical glitches abound in radio and TV, and so we had one tonight, but that's okay because I want to just tell our listeners a couple of things. This is Family Matters. Welcome to our Wednesday night show, and I think you're going to really be impressed by the content we have for you tonight. Brian McLaughlin is here. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him in just a moment. I wanted to tell all of you that are listening, on Saturday, June 30th, this coming Saturday, and this may be late notice, but for those of you who are in the Chicagoland area, we've been promoting this, and it's really exciting. We have Dr. Amy Baker coming from New York. She'll be in Chicago.
Nice.
It's terrific, doing a great seminar from 9 to 1 in the morning. In the afternoon will be attorney Brian Ludmer from Canada, who formerly alienated dad, but he is working now to help children get back to that target parent and regain a relationship with their parents. And last year in Canada, he returned 33 children to target parents. So he'll be speaking in the afternoon along with Judge Michelle Laurence. I'll be there. It's going to be just such an exciting day. We're almost sold out. So if you're looking to come, you can register at crckidsillinois.org. So please take a look. Very economical. It is $20 for the morning session, $20 for the afternoon session. People clamor to see Dr. Amy Baker to try to get to her, and she just doesn't have enough time. She is going to be there to give you information on parental alienation and parental alienation syndrome, and I am just so excited that we are able to provide this service to all these parents, mental health professionals, and legal professionals that are going to be there. So I will stop droning on about that, but please, if you want to come, or contact me on Facebook, or you can find me on the internet. I'm out there. So I want to tell you about this guest. I was looking one day just kind of, all my Facebook was up and my secretary was going through things, and she said, "Have you seen this about Brian McLaughlin?" And I said, "No." She said, "It is a book. It is called Have You Seen My Mother?" And I started reading about Have You Seen My Mother and this story. You know, I hear 400 to 600 stories a week from alienated parents all across the country and around the world. And Brian's story just is heart-wrenching. And I told him a little earlier, it reminds me of my own children. And whether you are kidnapped by a father and taken across the country, or kidnapped by a father or a mother and taken across town, you are losing that relationship with one or the other of your parents, and it's very sad. So, Brian, I want to welcome you. Thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you, Jill, and thank you for all that you do.
Well, you know, it's just what I got to do, Brian. It's what we got to do. We have to create awareness and educate, because that's where it's at right now. And boy, there is enough work to do, I think, don't you?
Oh, yes.
Well, let's get into this, because we have a lot of ground to cover. And I mean, really, it's your whole life. And, you know, I want to start by telling everybody that you are, when I saw your face, I knew I'd seen you before because you're an actor, you've been in Hollywood, you've been around, you're a famous guy. And, you know, for all of the things that you have, there were some things missing in your life. And I want you to just tell us your story and tell us about what happened to you from a very young age and kind of walk us through what happened. I'll interrupt you periodically, but I want this to be your hour to tell your story. And really, in a tribute to your mom, Angie, this show will be dedicated to her.
Thank you.
So go ahead.
Well, I was born in 64, mm-hmm. and in Oklahoma. Unfortunately, that was a time when there really were no parental abduction laws in our country. My father, when he married my mother, she was only 16. He was almost 10 years older than her. She had me at 17. The marriage wasn't working very well. My mother separated from him probably a year after my birth. And there was a bit of a struggle. My father actually kidnapped me one time. Then my mother went back to him, and she took me. My father ended up getting back with her, more or less deceiving her. He had gone to the Los Angeles area where she was living and took her to her mother's grave, which, by the way, her mother died 8 days after I was born, and she wasn't able to attend the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
So my father told her that he wanted to get back together, and he would consider moving out to the California area from Oklahoma. He just wanted to be a family again. So my mother, you know, thought it was a great thing, and they were driving back to a family friend whom she called Mom. It was essentially someone she's very close to. On the way there, my father started complaining of stomach problems, which, as long as I've known, he's had these issues with his stomach. I think it's stress, most likely. So he asked her to stop at a convenience store and get something for him. And he had actually given her the keys to his car so she would feel comfortable. So my mother went in the store to get some medicine for him. My father produced a second set of keys and took off. And that began my journey of life on the run for 6 years. We moved from Kentucky to Indiana, Arizona, Fayetteville, Arkansas, Rogers, Arkansas, League City, Texas, finally stopping in Houston, Texas. I mean, sorry, not Houston, but Kima, which is just south of Houston.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped there when I was 7 or 8 years old. It wasn't until I was 8 my father first asked me if I knew that my stepmother was not my real mother. And honestly, I knew my stepsisters weren't my real sisters, I imagine he probably taught me not to broach the issue because I never remember speaking about my real mom or any questions about who Joe, my stepmother, was.
Mm-hmm.
And my father told me that he had kidnapped me, and he told me the story that I just told you. But as you can imagine, I'm sure it goes back to when I was 2 years old, the alienation began very strong and hard long before I was able to really cognitively analyze the issue at hand. So when we discussed it, when I discussed this when I was 8, he had told me that my mother was demonized. I was born and raised in a very strict religious environment and demonic or demonism, demonic possession was, you know, a very real thing in my life. And I'm sure he used that in control. He knew. And it scared me very much. It made me not want to reach out to my mother. So, life went on.
Why? Let me stop you for a second, Brian.
Sure.
Why do you think at that moment, at 8 years old, Why do you think he chose at that time to share that information with you?
I believe that is right about the time that he received one of the letters from my mother begging to see me.
Okay.
And I think it just made him think about what he was doing. It's, he received that letter right around that time. And he gave the letter to me later. It's actually a copy of it is in my book.
That's the letter written in 1972.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
So I was born in 64, 72. That would be 8 years.
Okay.
And
I should say, everybody that hasn't read this book must get this book. But that letter, and Brian, would you feel comfortable reading that letter?
Sure, I can do that.
Would you? Because I just find it to be so representative of how a target parent feels. And your mom didn't know that's what she was then, because certainly there was not that vernacular. But in that letter, she is walking so carefully on eggshells to try not
yes.
to upset your father. And I find the content really interesting. So if you could read that.
Sure. I'm going to bring it up on my computer because I don't have that letter, the book with me.
Okay. Well, we'll keep
talking. Right here, though.
Okay.
Well, I've got it right here.
All righty.
So you'll notice that she speaks a lot about the religion. She kind of goes into it, speaking about that and family, kind of just typical, you know, nonchalant discussions or not broaching anything, and then she goes into about me.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, it's June 23rd, 1972, and the letter reads, Fred, I received your most welcome letters. Thank you very much for the papers that Brian did. They are really good. Okay, yeah. I'm reading it. It's coming up here.
Okay.
He prints really well, really nice. And thank you very, very much for the pictures. He is the cutest little guy I've ever seen. I love him so very much. I hope that someday you'll find it in your heart to let me see him. Does he know I'm his mother? Have you told him about me? Is he going to be tall? I imagine he's pretty tall now. What grade is he in? Fred, I'm so sorry you lost your mother, your grandmother. What will happen to your uncle now? My grandmother Mason died March 1572, and Mama Turner died the 21st of April 72. Have you told Brian about me? And if you don't care, if you don't mind, could I send him a picture of me? I hope he doesn't have a lot of problems with his teeth. Do you think his teeth will be straight? If he needs braces, I could help you with them. Fred, it's such a long time between letters. Could you write more often, please? Please let me know how Brian is doing from time to time. How does he do in the service? Is he shy? Does he take part in a theocratic ministry school? Thank you again, Angie.
How did you feel when you first read that?
You know, I haven't read this letter in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And normally when I'm speaking, I can't, you know, when I'm speaking to a crowd, it's tough for me to read it without crying.
Right.
I mean, just not to know the simple basic things about your own son and her reaching out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it tears me apart. It, you know, and what it led to after this, you know, it's obvious that her depression or despair, that it's tough. I mean, to be totally helpless,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. So that letter, as I said, is really representative of how a parent feels. You know, if you have contact with that alienator, and so many of us don't have contact with the alienator, so she was trying to appease your father, Fred, and trying to coax him into allowing her to participate in your teeth. You know, I think that's so great that she's thinking about how great your teeth are, and you have great teeth. It's just such a sad letter, and I can't imagine the first time that you read it how you felt after being told for so many years that she was this monster.
Right. And by the way, just so people understand, you know, we were on the run, so my father would actually write, when he would write her, he would write to his parents using my stepsister's names as the return address in case my mom got into their mailbox. And for her to get a letter, of course, to my dad, she would also write to his parents, and then they would forward it, again, in an envelope with my stepsister's names on the address.
Oh, my. Okay, so you're 8 years old, and you find this out. And then what happened?
Well, as I said, it scared me. So I really just buried it. You know, it's how a lot of children do it when they're, you know, being alienated. I remember being probably 5-6 years old and crying for my mother. And I think about it, it's like I was crying so hard I was just pushing out the words. It's kind of hard to describe. But, you know, I had a pretty abusive stepmother. My father, even though he says he was saving me from something, we had no relationship. He really wanted nothing to do with me. So it was odd being around these four people, but yet I was very lonely the whole time. I was usually made or told to go outside and play, even though my stepsisters would be in the house. Time went on, and I was 12 years old. I used to go to Oklahoma to spend my summers with my dad's family. It was great, you know, getting out of that house and somewhere else. And one of those families, my Uncle Ray and Aunt Ruth, really taught me what love was in a family. But my other aunt, she had given me a box when I was 12. And I cannot tell you the excitement that was running through my body when she gave that to me. And I'm sure that if she had asked my dad, he would not have let her do it. Mm-hmm. But she gave me a box which had a small white vase. It was a shoebox. There were a couple of letters in it. I'm trying to think of those letters my father gave me later. I think my father gave me some letters later that my mother wrote, but she didn't mail. There was a baby blanket, and in that box was the wedding picture of my mother and my father.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never seen a picture of my mother.
How'd you feel?
It was exciting. It wasn't pain. It wasn't fear or anything. I was just so excited. I remember running from their house to my grandfather's house. Just tell to tell my dad, because it wasn't until I found my mother that I realized how much my dad hated her.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way. You know, because he always put it off as he was protecting me, because, you know, we're in this religion and we can't, you know, allow this type of thing to come into our family. So yeah, it was great. At the same time, you know, looking back, I can't imagine I was 12 years old the first time I saw my mother.
And I think if you're like me, I often, when people will send me pictures of my youngest daughter, who looks exactly like me, only she's 6 foot tall and I'm 5 foot tall, I print those pictures off and I look for, you know, I look at the eyes, I cover the lower half of her face, I cover the upper half of her face, I try to see how much we actually look alike. Did you try to find that connection with your mom physically in that picture?
You know, I I didn't have to, and I don't think I was that aware of how I looked compared to how she looks.
Mm-hmm.
But my family, well, my father's family, always told me I looked like my mom.
You do look like your mom. You look like your mom was drop dead gorgeous.
Thank you. Yeah, she's a beautiful woman, and I'm actually very happy that I look like her and not my dad.
Yeah.
So you know, I've often wondered if that's what drove my father also, was waking up to see his son looks like his ex-wife every morning, you know.
When you said, Brian, that you thought your dad hated her so much, and clearly he did not like your mother, why do you think, what developed that hate?
You know, I'm not sure. My mother comes from a very abusive family, and maybe they just did not click as well as they thought, because actually I spoke with her father in April. It was his birthday. He's 82 years old, a man as sharp as a tack, and still drives his car, and I'm hoping I have his genes. But he told me that he said they had no clue they were even dating. He said they showed up at his work one day, and Fred asked him, my father asked him, if he could marry my mom. And so I don't think they dated very long at all. My mom did tell me that, you know, my father was a servant, like an elder in this organization,
mm-hmm.
and her mom was pushing her into the marriage because, you know, he's a servant, he's an elder, he has a position in the organization, you know, it's really a big deal. So I think maybe they just weren't matched up very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think my mom, I'm quite certain she didn't really want to spend her life out in the red sand of Oklahoma. You know, she liked a little more excitement in the Los mm-hmm. Angeles area, and perhaps they were fighting over that. But whatever it was, their relationship grew very sour.
How do you think he came to the point where he devised this scheme, and clearly premeditated, to abduct you? How could somebody, I mean, what was his background like with his parents, that he would ever think to take you away?
You know, I don't know. I do know that it was a cold family. Irish and German, which, you know, you don't think of the Irish as cold, really, but I know when I was going through a divorce, I was about 25, and I gave my father a hug at the airport in Houston as I was flying back to my house in Jersey, and he just stood there with his arms at his side as I hugged him. It was very weird, and he had told me, he said, you know, my mom never even told me she loved me until I was 25.
Hmm.
So and, you know, they were really a rebel family in Oklahoma. There were, you know, bar fights. I have my grandfather's brother was killed. He was shot in a bar. And I even spoke with one of my cousins who's a bit older than me. She knew my mom. She remembers cooking pies with my mom. And she said, I thought your mom was just so beautiful.
Hmm.
But she said, you know, I can see your dad doing that. Even the part where, you know, this whole story of rape, she says, I can see it. I can see it happening.
And so tell us about that. Your dad told you your mom was
my
raped.
My dad told me. What led up to this, I was really quiet about my mother from 8 years old until 15. And one day I went to the living room and I told my dad, I want to call my mom. And he starts going on about how I don't appreciate how good I have it there in his home, and how my mom, he said, you're old enough now. If she wanted anything to do with you, she would have already found you. And then he starts telling me, he says, I know one time your mom went horseback riding with some guy, and she was bucked off the horse, and she was knocked unconscious when she landed on the ground. And he said, while she was unconscious, this guy she went horseback riding with raped her. But then he says, your mom had the gall to brag to me that she wanted him to rape her, and she let him do it. And this was after they were married, and I was a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you can imagine, I'm 15 years old. My father just told me this about my mother, And I was devastated. That was the end of the whole argument. I just went upstairs.
You didn't want to ask any more questions after that.
I was done. I was just so hurt. And what I found out in the research for my book, speaking to actually my father's brother and his wife, they told a different story. I'd already found my mother, and their story was pretty much identical to my mother's story. And that story goes that my mother needed to get some milk or something for me. And I think during this time I'm about 9 months, probably about 9 months old, maybe a year. Mm-hmm. My dad wouldn't take her to the store. So my mom walked. While she was walking, two of my dad's cousins stopped to pick her up and give her a ride. And instead of taking her to the store, they took her to an abandoned house and they raped her. So there were no horses in the story at all. It wasn't some guy. And this is coming from...
No, just a couple of asses.
Yes. This is coming from my father's brother. Now, the way this story plays out, remember, I'm being raised in a very religious atmosphere. The only way my father could ever divorce my mother is if she commits adultery. Right. So that event, which, by the way, that same year, there was an article from this organization that said if a woman is being raped and she doesn't scream out, she's guilty of fornication. Doesn't matter if there's a gun to her head, a knife to her throat, she's guilty.
So by saying that she was passed out, that covered that?
Well, I think that's just the way he presented the story to me. I don't know if he was passed out or not. But, you know, my uncle and aunt, I spoke to them both at the same time, neither one of them said, well, you know, your mom asked for it or anything. No, they said she was raped.
Yeah.
So I'm certain it wasn't just a matter of my mother being wild or something. You know, if she's going to the store to get something for her baby, I don't think that would have been her intention.
And in the book, you indicate that your father paid his cousins to do that, right?
Well, I question it. And in fact, the whole incident, I don't have solid proof, but I do have proof that my father lied to me about it. So why would he lie? Mm-hmm. If my mother was a harlot and she was out screwing around with his cousins, why wouldn't he just say it instead of changing the whole story? And even his brother did not say my mother, you know, did something or was, you know, was bad or chasing guys, whatever the case may be. They said that she was picked up and raped. So with this event, my father was able to file for divorce to my mother and start his life anew, which what actually happened, that divorce did not go through. And, you know, I'm having to back up here a little bit. That is the time my mother came back to my dad, I believe. And so it would make sense why she left again.
Mm-hmm.
But, so anyway, that was that. So I'm 15, and that's the story he tells me. And in the research of my book, after I found my mother, my uncle's story matches my mother's story.
I want to stop you there for a second, and then we'll start again when you were 15. But you keep referring to the church. Are you hesitant to say what church?
No.
So I'll say it.
Correct. I don't know what you would like. So I was raised a Jehovah's Witness.
Jehovah's Witness, you know, I find it interesting that I mean they're very strict, obviously, and they don't celebrate any holiday, including birthdays, right?
Right. They do have their own celebration of the memorial, they call it, where they, you know, the Christ's blood and flesh thing they do, but only very few actually partake because, you know, they think only 144,000 are going to heaven. Everyone else stays on the earth.
Right.
And so, like, you know, the 144,000 hasn't already been filled since Jesus died. But anyway, That's it, yeah. No celebrations. My first Christmas, I was 25 years old.
Wow. It must have been a fun Christmas. Well, there's
a
passage in the book that Jack, your mother's husband, tells about when the Jehovah Witnesses would come around knocking on the door wanting to sell their magazines, and he told them about what your dad did, and every time he asked them to help them find you, and they would throw their hands up and say, oh no, we can't do that, we don't get involved in that stuff.
Yes.
You know, that's a real problem I have, because I think you could replace Jehovah Witnesses with Assembly of God, with any other religion. People don't want to get involved, and I found and I find with all the people that I talk to that the church that you attended will line up on either side, whichever side they choose. And I went to 21 years, and they lined up on his side. He was never there. He gave money, but I did everything, including the singing and drama and everything. And the church, all these Christian people line up on the side of wrong. And it's unfortunate that, you not only were alienated, but then you had this other force driving that behind it. And in your case, I mean, I think it was even more intense than what I feel after reading your book, that Jehovah's Witnesses have a much more intense experience than a lot of other religions.
Yeah, they're very strict. And actually, there's just a new guilty verdict against them that involved child sexual abuse.
Ah.
And the whole thing is, it's protect the church.
Yeah.
Period. And so when they would speak to Jack, my mom's husband, he'd tell the story, like, no, because they're protecting their members, their church.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't want to be involved. They just want to sell their magazines and be on their way.
Yep.
Brian, we have a caller. I'm going to grab this call, and hopefully they will have a question for you. It's from Chicago. Welcome. Mm-hmm. What's your name?
Oh, Jill, do you have me?
Hi. Do you have a question for Brian?
Yes, I do. I'm wondering how the relationship with his father has evolved after Brian got to meet his mother and start a relationship with his mother.
And thanks for the question. When I found my mother, it took about 3 months, and my father told me, I hope you two have a great life. That was 1997, and he has not spoken to me since. And, everyone says, you must hate your father. I don't hate my father. I don't have room in my life for hate. I think that hurts me more than anyone else.
Yeah.
I was raised to say yes, sir, no, sir. And of course, because my father, he was very strict with me. So I look at it as, and the way I really feel is, I'm doing this out of respect for his wishes. I don't contact him. If he wants to talk to me, he can call me.
Well, how about the relationship with his family?
Well, most of the family, it's not a good relationship because most of them are still witnesses. And I left the witnesses in about 1993. And so, of course, I'm shunned by most of them. And, of course, once I wrote the book, they really didn't like that. So I do have a couple of cousins that... three cousins probably that I have a really good relationship with. I actually just moved from Washington State to New Orleans, and I visited several of them on my way down. But that's the sad thing about this organization is once you leave, you're considered an apostate, and then you're more evil than those who have never been a witness. So you lose all your family and friends when you leave. If that's, like myself, I was born into it. It's very inclusive, so your friends are witnesses, your family, many can or cannot be witnesses, but whoever it is you have the contact with, you lose them.
So really, they practice parental alienation under the guise of religion.
Yes. Yes.
They practice alienation of all under the guise of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you want to be a Jehovah's Witness too bad. How do they get those people in there, Brian? How do they make them want to come to that church? No birthdays? What's wrong with them?
Right. I find that a lot of people who who get into it that are adults, they usually are in a crisis, going through a divorce or something, and they feel like they need something. Mm-hmm. And they do what we call love bombing, where just, you know, oh, you know, it's so wonderful here. They, you know, it's all hugs and kisses. And then if you've been in for a while, you know, of course they don't tell you while they're studying with you that you have to leave all your non-witness family behind and friends. But, yeah, that or you're born into it.
Okay, so let's go back to the story. 15 years old. Take us from there.
Okay, well, after that, I mean, I was destroyed after that argument. So again, as when I was 8 years old, now he made me not want to reach out. He succeeded again. And remember, through this whole time, I don't understand my father's hatred for my mother. Mm-hmm. So 3 years later, I'm about to be married at 18 years old, way too young. But I was in the woods of East Texas, and that's what you do. So I told my father that I wanted to invite her to the wedding. And he says he would make a few calls and try and find out, you know, where she was and everything. So he left, went up to his bedroom, and about 45 minutes later, he comes back down. And he told me that he had found someone who knew my mother back in California and that she had died. So, and, you know, really the sad part of that is when I asked him this, my soon-to-be wife and I were planning our wedding. And so my father comes down, we're still working things out, and he tells me this. And I kind of reflect for just a second, and then I go back to planning my wedding. That's how strong the alienation was. I mean, I've been told my mother had just died, or my mother was dead, and I didn't even grieve. I didn't cry. I didn't think for more than 60 seconds about it. I went back to planning my wedding.
Yeah.
So that went on, and I still held on to her. One of my most prized possession was that shoebox. And I remember after I was married, probably a year, maybe even less, the shoebox actually fell out of the closet when I opened the sliding door. And that vase came crashing down and broke into a million pieces on the floor. And that's probably the first time in years I had cussed, because your witnesses don't cuss. So my wife and mother came running in because they thought, what in the world is it if he's speaking like that? And I picked up all the pieces. And actually, I threw them away, and I was very angry. I was so mad.
Well, it was just really symbolic of your mom.
Yes, I mean, she picked this out. She put flowers into this. This was the closest thing I had to her physical being. And I just, you know, I was mad. I was upset. I threw it in the trash. And that night, we went to bed, and I cried. I cried like a kid. Mm-hmm. I was so sad. But as time went on, went through a divorce, you know, marrying so early, it's not uncommon. Mm-hmm. And I was had moved to Jersey because there was remember the oil bust in the 80s in Houston, in Texas. So I gone to Jersey where there was more work. I was a bricklayer at the time. Being single, and I'd actually also let the witnesses for the first time. It took me two tries to get out. I finally got out. It's a huge emotional burden trying to get out of that organization. But I decided I wanted to find my mother's gravesite. So I started just calling. You know, this is back before the internet. So I started, I'd call up the operator and ask for names of people. I think she would give me three, sometimes five different phone numbers of people who had the last name of my mom's family. So it was so funny, but not funny, but it was really kind of sweet that I would tell these operators what I'm doing. I'm trying to find my mom. I haven't seen her since I was two.
And they would give you more numbers.
Extra numbers. Yeah. It was very sweet. But I never found her. I never found her gravesite. Never found any family. And I just kind of became, you know, I moved back to Houston a few years later, and I became the guy who's looking for his mom. It was like, I would tell my story, or meet people all the time, you know. Yeah, if you met Brian, he's still looking for his mom. And I happened upon a friend of a friend. I had never met him, and he has asked me not to give out his name because he doesn't. He just says, I just want to do this for you, and I don't care. So I think that's one of the two people I used a different name for in the book. And he tells me one night we're, you know, at a piano bar, and a friend of ours is playing the piano, and he says, you know, I think I can help you find your mom. And I was like, really? And he had a friend who was a detective of sorts, and I never met this person, don't know who they are. It only took about 3 days, seems like. It was less than a week, I know. And he calls me up and he says, I have something for you. So he came by and he said, I want you to know that your mother is alive. And he says, he says, she doesn't have a phone number, but I have an address for her.
Oh, my God.
You can write her a letter if you want.
And how far away was she from where you were?
Well, she was in McAllister, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Maybe 8 hours away.
Yeah.
I'd actually driven within miles of her house more than once. So I wrote a letter. I think it was a two or three page letter. And, excuse me.
It's okay.
I think one of the most odd things about myself, looking back at what I wrote, because I of course dreamed about my mom. And my dad had really struck a note with me when he told me, you're 15 years old. You're old enough. If your mother wanted to find you, she could. So that was a question I always had in my mind. Maybe my mom is happy in her own life, you know. Maybe she's got a new family. Things are going well, and she doesn't really want anyone to rock the boat. So in my letter, I told her, you know, what was going on and... Mm-hmm. And I ended it by saying that I left the ball in her court. I'm here. If you want to have a relationship with me, you know, this is my number, my address, and, you know, I hope to hear from you, but if you don't, I understand. So... I got a phone call one day from Jack, my mom's husband.
Mm-hmm.
And he was calling me from a payphone. And he says, I have your letter. And he says, I haven't told your mom that you wrote it yet. Because he said there were family members. Remember, my mom was raised in abusive families, kind of a very odd group of people. And he said... I can't tell you how many times they've said they're coming by here to see her, and they don't show up. He says, if you want to see your mom, that's great, but I'm not going to tell her you're coming until...
You're here.
You're here, yes. But he did tell me, he says, I want you to know, your mom is not like you would expect to find her. It turns out that not too long after she wrote that letter to my dad... when I was eight, that she gave up and she tried to kill herself. And she succeeded only in damaging her brain. So my mom really is like a big kid.
Mm-hmm.
She knows what's going on around her. You know, she can have limited conversations, but that's what she is. And I'm like, "Oh, Jack, no, I'm coming. Are you kidding me?" Yes.
Right away. You were out of there and on the way, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, within days I was gone.
Yeah.
I flew to Tulsa, had to drive south. And go ahead.
No, well, so you got there. Jack then met you and brought you in to your mother. And what was that first time seeing her like?
I'll tell you what, I will back up a little bit, Jill.
Okay.
To the drive from Tulsa to McAllister. I've never had so many emotions at one time in my life, conflicting emotions. It was amazing to begin with, because I've never felt that before, and I haven't felt it since. But, I mean, I had fear, I had joy, I had burgeoning love, and
probably uncertainty, because you didn't know how she would react.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, I had been this guy all my life looking for his mom. And now, that's who I was. That's who I came to be, that being. And I was about to stop all that. I was about to be someone different. So I managed to get lost. Jack came by, found me, because I do live out in the country. And so he opens the door and just stands there and lets me walk across the threshold.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom is sitting there in her chair. She has these long gray Cherokee locks.
Mm.
And she's rocking back and forth, and she looks up and down. She keeps looking up and down, up and down. And I had taken her flowers. I went, set the flowers down next to her on her table and hugged her. She just started bawling. We were both crying, but you know, she said, "My boy, come back to me. My boy, come back to me."
Aww.
And she, you know, she was saying, "You're not going to leave me again, are you, boy? You're not going to leave me again, are you?" Just over and over.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was quite a reunion.
And so today, your mom?
My mom, you know, when I found her, she could do the dishes, and she could use the bathroom by herself.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they didn't have a phone is because if she's walking, the ringing of the phone would startle her and she would fall.
Oh.
So she always wore a bicycle helmet in the house. Well, she was always in the house, but if she ever got up, she had to put the bicycle helmet on. She's put holes in walls and broken fingers and stuff from falling. And probably 7 years ago, she fell and broke her ankle. And she doesn't have the cognitive ability to understand left and right.
Mm-hmm.
So the therapy wouldn't work for her. She just couldn't understand how to do it. So it didn't heal back very well, and since then she hasn't been able to walk. So, you know, Jack puts her in a wheelchair, and he wheels her to her potty, and back to her chair, and then to bed, and back to her chair. So her life has been probably at least the past 15, 20 years just watching TV.
Yeah. Thank God for Jack.
Yes. Yeah. I told him that. He's my angel, my mom's angel. Without him, I don't know.
There's another, we have about eight, nine minutes left, and there's another component to this I just want you to touch on, that you are also an alienated dad.
Yeah.
And you have a daughter you haven't seen.
Yes, but I do have good news for you.
What is it?
That we are back together now, my daughter and I.
Oh, Brian, I am so happy for you. You're who we all want to be right now. That's so
Thank
great.
You. Thank you.
Oh, lovely. So is she in Louisiana with you?
No, she is married. You know, mm-hmm. the letter she wrote me was that she was at 19, she wrote me a letter saying, you know, the court documents said I had to visit you until I was 18. Now I'm 19 and I'm about to get married, but you're not invited to the wedding because I don't want an apostate at the wedding. Ends up, you know, I sent her, you know, guys, remember this, always send the emails, regardless if you think they're getting them or not, if you hear back from them or not, you send the emails. I did this every few months for years. And on the sixth year of our separation, I sent her an email for her wedding anniversary, and she replied. And the emails are very sterile for a month or two, and then she emails me that she wants to talk to me, but she doesn't like to talk about serious things on the phone. So, of course, I'm like, I'll fly you here, I'll fly there, whatever you want, I will do it. So I flew her up to see me there in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
And ends up, it's odd because I'm a very touchy-feely kind of dad. I'm always saying I love you because my dad never did that.
Right.
But she told me, she said, I didn't think you loved me. And I told her, I said, Anna, I've always told you I loved you. I'm always holding on to you. And she said, I know, I don't really understand it. But the thing is, you know, she said it's all the stuff her mom told her, that all her mom's family, they're all Jehovah's Witnesses. So not only did her mom want to alienate her from me, but you have the rest of the family saying, well, he's an apostate now, you know.
Right.
He's evil.
Yeah.
He's demonized, as my father did me. So I'm so happy to say that when my daughter left, she said that she was so happy that she came, that she had a huge weight lifted off of her shoulders. And she and I are now in constant contact.
Oh, I'm so happy for you, Brian. That's great.
And I will tell you, too, she's told me that, she says, I don't have any memories of me and Mom when I was a kid. She says, I have loads of memories of you and me.
Because that's what she longed for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Well, does she have children?
No.
No,
she's not. She's been married for 8 years, I think, but she's, I would tell you that she's not, at least when she visited me, she's not really certain that the marriage is the right one. So I think since she met with me and this weight was lifted off, she's kind of got back into life with a new start.
Good.
But I think she's holding off to make sure.
Good. Oh, boy, that's a great end to a story, a relationship with your mom, a relationship with your daughter. And then there's the other part of you right now that's doing this terrific, terrific awareness documentary. And I want you to tell me a little bit about that.
Well, what I'm doing, I've been interviewing former abductees who are now adults who are kidnapped just because by a parent from the West Coast, Portland, Oregon, and Vancouver, Washington, Kennewick, Washington. And on my drive down here, I stopped and interviewed Ken Connolly. You probably know Ken Connolly.
Mm-hmm.
His book, Throwing Stones.
Yeah.
Interviewed him in Dallas. And I did interview my mother again and Jack. And I have another interview in Houston to do soon. But I'm putting together all these people who will tell me their story. And what I'm trying to show is the abuse that we really suffered. It's not, you know, we know the cliche, you know, people think, oh, they've been kidnapped by a parent, they're safe. Well, that's not the right case. I mean, I may not die because I was, you know, kidnapped by my father, but I'm going to have to deal with his psychological abuse for the rest of my life. I still deal with it.
Yeah.
And one of the most, I think the most common thing I'm hearing from everyone so far is lack of trust. They don't trust themselves, and they don't trust others.
Well, and that coupled with the inability to have relationships, self-esteem loss.
Yeah, and how do you build relationships if you can't trust?
Right. I mean, if you were indoctrinated to throw away one of the most meaningful relationships that you had,
yes,
how could you ever have another really meaningful relationship?
Yeah.
So it's unfortunate. I think one of the things, you know, the thing that I told you this before, the first thing you said to your mom, I think a great tragedy in life is living yours in the shadows of the decision that others make.
Yes, yeah.
I think that just speaks volumes and is quite a statement. And I really hope that, you know, I know you were directing that at your mom, but I hope all our kids, you know, all our kids who are adults now can really move out of that shadow of alienation and work toward making their own decisions and not having to choose who they're going to love. And I think what
right.
you're doing, Brian, coupled with what all of the other really strong activists and advocates are doing all over the country and all over the world, is going to really make a positive change in divorce culture and really help some other kids not have to go through this.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Now, I'll tell you what, you know, I know we're running short on time, so cut me off when you need to.
Sure.
But parents have got to stop putting themselves before the kids. I was recently divorced 2.5 years ago, and next month I'm driving my ex-wife and my son to Disneyland, and we're going to spend 2 weeks there. Not because I want to be around her. We've stayed friends, but I'm really not that comfortable being around her. But I do know that my son is going to be so ecstatic having both of us on a big trip, and that's why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
People have got to learn, put the kids first. Get rid of the hate, the jealousy, whatever it is, and understand it's your kid's life you're trying to help.
Well, and when people enter into having children, that is a responsibility that you can't take. It's very, very serious. And
yes.
and this is the future of our country, the future of our world, and we need to really be invested in this.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Brian, I appreciate you so much. How can they get your book if they want to buy it? You're on Amazon?
Yes. If you'd like a signed copy from me, a song for $10, $5 for shipping, just find me on Facebook. I'm kind of in transition with my moving and stuff. My websites are in transition also.
Okay.
Just look me up on Facebook and we can figure something out.
Brian McLaughlin.
If you want a signed copy.
Facebook or contact me, I'll get you to Brian. And this show, again, was dedicated to Brian's mom, Angie. And now
thank you so much.
And one of the dedication in this book is, she fought so hard and lost so much. I love you, Mom, and I'll never leave you again. Brian, thank you. You're an incredible, incredible witness to what's happening to children all across America, and I appreciate your time, and we'll do this again, okay?
Thank you, Jill. And again, thank you so much for what you're doing.
You're welcome.
Really.
And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Everyone have a great night. Thanks for listening. This was Family Matters. Bye-bye.